All right, all right. How's everybody doing tonight? It's episode 2 of Left Reckoning. My name is David Griscom, and I'm here joined by my friend and comrade, Matt Leck. How are you doing tonight, brother?
I'm doing pretty good, David. I'm doing pretty good. Happy to be with all the Left Reckoning crew tonight.
It's pretty fun. Before we do this, I have to post everything on all the different social media. It's like running, you know, trying to run down a train, making sure I get it in time, but I think I got it. Well, tonight we got a pretty exciting show. We are going to be joined in just a few minutes by a longtime crew and friend of the Michael Brooks Show, Daniel Bessner, who will be joining us to talk about Joe Biden's foreign policy, and also the pitfalls of technocratic liberalism, sort of reasserting the definition of those two words, which a lot of people got.
There's a lot of sensitive liberals that align with the Democratic Party, shall we say.
Sensitive liberals, that's a new concept for me. So we got that coming. We're going to break down also just what is starting to look like a very pathetic fight over just the bare minimum amount of stimulus that's needed for working people in this country to offset the damage that the coronavirus crisis has caused for so many folks. Also, we're going to talk about how workers are standing up against the despicable Prop 22 in California. And in the post game, we're going to be doing a segment honoring and remembering the greatest poster of all time, soon to be former President Donald Trump. We're going to be going through some really great footage of the great socialist writer and thinker Leo Panitch, along with much, much more. But to get started, Matt, I think we have some pretty exciting news, or at least just the smallest modicum of justice that you could expect after the devastating, horrific actions of a former governor, Snyder.
Yeah, so Governor Rick Snyder, a.k.a. One Tough Nerd on Twitter, who's a guy who became a millionaire in Silicon Valley as a venture capitalist, basically, and then became a governor. He has been charged with two misdemeanors of willful neglect for his time as governor overseeing the Flint crisis, where they decided to take some shortcuts that ended up poisoning, you know, people's brains in that community. And I guess I'm a little bit surprised, to be honest. I think it should be more than misdemeanors, but I wasn't expecting misdemeanors. And it's interesting the reaction you have from his lawyers, for instance, saying it's all politically motivated, for instance. Well, it's like, maybe that's why you were so vocal about endorsing Biden. I don't know. There's some self-interest there. And also, you know, Biden should be shamed for, and DNC people, whoever's idea it was to like, hey, let's tout this endorsement, should be marginalized. Well, of course they won't be, but we have a little bit of clip from his, he's live from Genesee jail booth. Number 2 is the governor here. And speaking with the judge, and we'll just show a little bit of this where he pleads not guilty. Oops, let me go back.
Any questions by 8:30 a.m. Judge Crawford is all right. Any questions about
that? Hold on, I have this note here. 29 minutes, 20.
Not from the people, Your Honor.
No, Your Honor.
Yeah, here we go.
All right. The next hearing is January 19th, 8:30 a.m. Judge Crawford is the assigned judge. Any questions by either party?
Nothing from the people, Your Honor.
Just for the record, of course, Your Honor, not guilty charges or pleas on each charge. Thank you.
Yes, sir. Better pleas than not guilty. Thank you. Have a nice day, everybody.
All right. So that's that. Beforehand, they talk about, bail and travel restrictions, and the prosecution asks for him to turn his passport. The judge declines that, and they brag that Schneider's the only governor since like one a while back that actually stayed in Michigan past leaving office. But apparently he has to get permission to leave the state of Michigan now. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I hope that I'm thankful for the charges. I'm thankful for whoever's in that department that feels the need to like do more than just look at like the people that you can peg this on, right? The lower mm-hmm. level functionaries. It's interesting. The other thing I want to stress, though, is this is not just Rick Schneider and this is not just Flint. There's a whole number of different communities that you can find. I have my notes here, but you have. I had a few up here. I have too many tabs open. I had a story in Wired, but I think it's gone now. But I mean, multiple, if you just search your community and area, you might have a water problem issue. Right. Like these pipes, the issue with these pipes is there, a lot of them were put in when, you know, the American government was actually putting in infrastructure projects like, 80, 70 years ago and haven't been done up since then.
There's no doubt about it. You know, I would just add, I did a pretty in-depth gem on this a couple of years ago about the crisis of water privatization in this country. In the United States in particular, you saw during the kind of fetish of neoliberalism and particularly of city governments selling off of their assets, that you saw all of these cities fall into significant risk, not only selling off their water directly so they're no longer publicly owned utilities, but also just bringing in contractors to do the kind of critical work. And if you're a contractor who's supposed to be doing repair work, it oftentimes is better for you to overlook some of the bigger repairs so you don't have to put in the time and effort to actually adequately maintain these systems. I mean, you know, Snyder's absolutely disgusting, but I think it's a good point to make, Matt, that he's one, not alone. And two, you know, we got all of this, this, you know, ridiculous pageantry from Obama too. You remember when he drank the water in Flint, Michigan, when it was still dirty? And it was one of those things where most of the time, incredibly earnest from people using this as a meme, saying things like, oh, Flint still doesn't have clean drinking water. And refusing to recognize the complicity too of, you know, the Democratic Party in particular, Barack Obama, and shielding, you know, the blame and not dealing with the crisis when they had the opportunity to do so as well.
Yeah, Schneider's defense is he was just following the orders of experts, and I assume that this is something I should have looked at before, but I assume the contracts that those experts are signing limit their liabilities. We also have the story in Wired of Toledo, to name one. There's also one in Iowa and Dukeville. I can't remember where Dukeville's at. This is regarding Toledo. The Ohio Department of Health estimates that as many as 19,000 children in the state have elevated levels of lead. Children in Toledo tested positive for lead poison at nearly double the statewide rate, according to a 2016 report. I mean, that's the thing is, like, we're not even really treating Schneider as what he should be treated like, but like it can get too narrowed even if we did, right? Like, I mean, we have a massive, and, you know, we're going to talk a little bit later about what Biden needs to do to not get swamped in the next midterms in terms of a positive agenda for people. And it's interesting to see, I forget what his name is, but one of the centrist guys said, yeah, we need to do big infrastructure stuff. It can't just be, you know, this or that. We need to actually, like, put people to work. And here we go. We have a massive job. I mean, water infrastructure, power infrastructure, the infrastructure needs to be done, put people to work.
I think that's 100% right. And I just want to bring up this story too, you know, to just remind everybody, from Pittsburgh to Flint, the dire consequences of giving private companies responsibility for ailing public water systems. In particular, is this company, which I'm probably mispronouncing, Veolia, which is a French company, I believe, which has been linked both in Pittsburgh and Flint to just gross negligence. And this comes out of a neoliberal like ideology that what you have to do first and foremost is cut costs, no matter what the actual human consequences. And it should also be noted that I don't think that it's an accident that so many people don't trust their public drinking water in this country. When you look at companies like Nestle, which are just basically trying to suck up access to water all across the globe, and in particularly in the United States too, there has been an ongoing campaign to make people think that public utilities just generally aren't safe. And they aren't safe when you mismanage them. right? But there's nothing inherent.
I think you can just ride them for multiple decades.
Yeah. So it's like, you know, you maintain those systems, but you won't be able to maintain those systems if any kind of public spending is constantly railed against by both the right and the left wing. And this is the actual human disaster, the human cost of those systems is what we're seeing in Flint and in cities all across the country. I mean, our water infrastructure in this country, as Matt was mentioning, is very much at risk.
We have, it was Dukeville, Indiana, and it was just like today, published January 14th. Here's the story. Once again, Dukeville faces water quality questions, with some residents of Dukeville area facing elevated levels. Like, this is not an isolated Flint thing. I think that's important to stress, because it requires response, because people are actively being poisoned and lives are being, you know, I mean, the future trajectory of people's lives is being affected because they don't have safe drinking water and they can't, like, I mean, it's brain development, folks. And it's amazing. Like, we talk about the callousness of the coronavirus response, but I mean, really, this is just how this country responds to this stuff.
I think that's 100%, 100% on point. And, you know, again, I hope that we're able to see some kind of, punishment for these actions, but just knowing how politicians are venerated in this country, and it's very difficult to see anyone being actually prosecuted in the first place for their political crimes, let alone convicted, so nothing but hope there.
Right. Should we touch on we should, one thing Michael always did up front that we haven't really done is plug the show.
Yeah,
so maybe this is probably the point we should do this, folks. Patreon.com/leftreckoning is where you can become a member of the show and get, we had the very first post game last week, which was very enjoyable. We'll have the very second one after this show this evening. So if you want access to that, patreon.com/leftreckoning. And also be sure to check us out at twitch.tv/leftreckoning for those who are on Twitch.
And also on that, tomorrow at 5, I'm going to be doing a Griscom stream, because there's a lot that I want to be able to cover, particularly around political strategy. And I know Matt had a little dust up earlier today regarding people who think that we can just will, a stronger left into existence. And I think that that's one of the biggest delusions that we're facing right now in this really serious crossroads moment where we're about to enter, and we're going to talk with Daniel Bessner about this a bit. We're about to enter a moment of a really resurgent neoliberalism. One in which a lot of people aren't going to recognize who their enemies are anymore, because a lot of people who, especially people who've joined the left in the past 4 years, it became really easy for them to recognize their enemy when it's just this disgusting orange clown, closing the borders to prevent, Muslim immigrants from coming into the country, cutting social services, putting like one of the most disgusting lobbyists and wealthy people in the country, Betsy DeVos, in charge of education. It's really easy to see those forces then. But now that we're in a moment with, Joe Biden, when a lot of people think that we're returning to normalcy, we're going to be in an incredibly dangerous moment when it comes to people wanting to join political organizations and recognizing that politics is something that is quite critical for their lives, to better their lives and also to defend themselves and their communities. That if we don't start getting much more serious about the way that we're trying to develop our movements, we are going to fall into a crisis where you're just going to have, half of the people who've been activated in this past 4 years tune out. And then the other half are just going to fall into critique. And again, critique is all well and good. I mean, it's very important. It's something that, I do.
We do an awful lot of
it. Yeah. But, criticism on its own without any other kind of program or movement behind it isn't going to fundamentally change the world around it. And you need to start thinking strategically in addition to critically. And anyways, I'm just teasing a little bit of what I want to get into tomorrow there. And I think I'm all fired up, man. I mean, this is what I've been going on for a while. Most of my Griscom streams are about two things: against left pessimism and for better understanding of what populism and political organizations are.
Let's do a little bit on Biden. So okay. just to kind of get to the headline of the show, at least before Daniel gets here. So what it looks like now is Biden is going to give you the $2,000, but by that he means they're going to top up the $600 that you just got with $1,400 more, which is not something that I expected. David, I think, had some inkling of it. It's very Democrat and on brand for them. And I think, the demand has to be absolutely more. And why are we trying most, I guess, to the point, to have unity with people who, Joe Biden, I'm talking to you now, have unity with people who don't acknowledge that you won the election? You can't do that. That's all I have to say about that. Anything you want to say?
I mean, I just have to add to this. Joe Biden, as we talk right now, is releasing his plan. So I haven't had a chance to go through. What we've seen from the early reports is it's going to be a $1.9 trillion plan, that's going to basically give, again, bare minimum kind of basic money to a vaccine rollout, which is like, that's not even politics. That's just like management. That's just like, if your job, is to organize the vaccine rollout, give them more money in the middle of a global pandemic, right? And then again, as Matt was mentioning, these $1,400 checks, along with stimulus for city and state governments, which is something that was desperately needed that the GOP refused. I'm not against those things. I'm against the scale, and I'm against the way that I know that it's about to be rolled out. Because the thing is, like, this is like March 1st, 2020 plan. Like, this is what you do in the when this has just started, and people are still trying to figure out, what's going on. Okay, we have to prepare for lockdowns, whatever. Okay, we're going to give people some money. We're going to give extra resources to, the health system. We're going to give extra resources to city and state governments to be able to provide people the necessary services, right? That's what you do then. Right now, we're sitting in a moment where, what is it? The most recent job numbers, we lost 140,000 jobs in December. So it's going down again, right? Nearly 10 million people. There's a deficit of 10 million people who aren't working, who were at the beginning of this crisis in this country. We are still in the middle of this crisis, right? Not to mention the fact that billionaires in this country increased their wealth by $1 trillion. And that was at the beginning of December. It might even be larger now, right? We are in the middle of this crisis. And we're getting headlines in Bloomberg saying that Joe Biden is planning on negotiating and working primarily with Republicans to make sure that his plan gets through, not taking advantage of the fact that they now control the Senate and the House, yes, by slim majority, but there are plenty of ways that they can put through a lot of necessary plans in this moment. And hell, just ram it through in the sense that, remember, there was a pretty historical event that happened last week with the Republican Party and some of its supporters where they stormed the Capitol. There is no moral authority that the Republican Party has right now to stand against giving people money and taking care of people in a pandemic. So any kind of argument that the first position that the Biden administration should take should be bringing in the Republican Party, doing bipartisanship, which is, again, that's a word when you hear that you should worry, is BS. And it's just a great reminder of the kind of politician that Joe Biden is. He's not a transformative politician.
I have one, and it's not operative at all, which is that if Joe Biden wants to pretend like, hey, I'm this reach across the aisle guy, and then immediately when the Republicans say no, crush them, I think that's a good approach.
Sure.
But that's obviously not one that this leadership is going to take in any universe we're aware of. Let's bring Daniel on.
Hell yeah.
All right. So while I get set up, joining us now is Daniel Bessner. He's an S-tier TMBS guest. People probably know who should be familiar with his work. Mm-hmm. He is the Joff Hanauer Honors Associate Professor in Western Civilization at the University of Washington, an intellectual historian of U.S. foreign relations. He is the author of Democracy in Exile, Hans Speier, and the Rise of the Defense Intellectual, a great book that I actually read last summer. What was that?
That makes two of us. You tripled my sales by buying a copy.
Let me just give a short pitch. Is like, the Rand Institute intellectual history is great, but people might not know there's a Frankfurt School stuff in there too. There's a wide swath of intellectual history you get in that book. So I recommend that. He's also a contributor to Jacobin and the excellent Foreign Exchanges Substack, which informed a lot of this interview run by Derek Davison, which I am a subscriber to. Daniel Bessner, thanks for joining Left Reckoning.
Thank you, my two beautiful boys. It's the very beginning of your new venture. I'm so excited and honored to be such an early guest. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, well, we're happy to have you. I think, it feels very good to have you on. So, I mean, to start it off, let's go to a conversation I think we've had similar with you. But like, the Democrats now are in the position to return to what Biden's been calling leadership, world leadership. We're going to return to this. Talk a little bit about what we can expect from this return to world leadership.
Sure. So I think that's one thing that's really important just to understand generally is about the foreign policy bureaucracy is actually not as institutionalized in a particular way in the sense that once a new president comes, they write a memo, literally a memo, and that is supposed to kind of lay out how they want foreign policy to be undertaken, like who's going to be most powerful, who's going to be responsible for X, Y, and Z. So in some sense, we just fundamentally don't know what that memo is going to look like, right? You know, what responsibilities X or Y is going to get. There's an incredible amount of discretionary power, particularly in the executive. So be that as it may, I just want to make that, you know, maybe there's some wacky memo that's coming that we don't know what'll happen. But so I just wanted to get that out of the way. But the thing is, you also have to examine, like, what is the president himself? Well, what are they doing? What type of president is Joe Biden likely to be? Is he likely to be someone who is going to be very involved in the details of what's going on in his administration? Or is he not likely to be someone who is going to be very involved in that way? My prediction is that he's probably not going to be someone who's particularly involved in the details. One, because he's never really been that sort of politician throughout the duration of his career. And two, he's obviously experiencing some form of cognitive decline. And that cognitive decline is not going to be improved with 5,000 things coming at him every day when he's president. So I imagine a lot of the foreign policy, which is not going to be at the front of his mind, is going to be undertaken by a lot of his appointments. So the question then is, who is he appointed? So you have Tony Blinken, you have Jake Sullivan, you have Samantha Power. You have basically what I would classify as the people who were lower level executives in the Obama administration, people who weren't the absolute principal decision makers like Hillary Clinton or Leon Panetta or Bob Gates or Joe Biden himself, but people who were the assistants to a lot of those people have now been appointed the principals, the people who will actually not just be whispering in power's ear, but who will be making decisions. So then what do you have to go on? You have to go on what they did during the Obama administration and what they wrote. So on one hand, we don't really 100% know what actually happened in the Obama administration because of the very fact is the documents haven't been released. So you can't look at these 5,000 memos and see who actually did what. So what we're relying on is pretty much memoir and reportage. So what does it look like given that? So I would say, and then I'll stop rambling. Sorry, this is a bit long answer, but I just want to sort of contextualize it for everyone. Perfect. So there's a difference between the first Obama administration and the second Obama administration. The first Obama administration was more willing to use force and to basically abide by the traditional status quo of American foreign policy. You get essentially the increase in troops in Afghanistan, and most disastrously, you get the intervention in Libya. The second Obama administration, a little less. You don't get when Assad crossed the so-called red line, you don't get then some sort of massive retaliation, which you might have seen in the first time Obama administration. So the question is it going to be more first Obama or more second Obama? I think it's probably likely to be more first Obama administration because I think the people who he appointed are on the hawkish end of the liberal spectrum. So if you look at Obama's memoir, who are the people who are advocating for intervention in Libya? Who are the people who are advocating to quote unquote do something in Syria? Who are the people who are advocating that you want to like do something about the Arab Spring? Send bombs, you know, send weapons, whatever it may be. And it's mostly people like Blinken, it's Samantha Power, it's Jake Sullivan, it's people like that. So given that, I would say, at least as it stands now, is that it's more likely to be first-time Obama. But again, it's not 2008, right? So there is like this real criticism of at least endless war and constant military deployment. That is a genuine thing within the Democratic Party. And the question is, how is that new critique going to interact with people who have spent their careers essentially advocating American intervention in the world? And I think those are the questions that we will face.
I'd be really curious to hear, because you do this very well. What do people like Power and Blinken in particular believe, their ideology in the sense of like, what do they think America's role in the world is? I think that you talk specifically, you know, the transition from today versus people who came, you know, into power during like the Cold War or developed their political, consciousness during that period of time.
It's a great question, and this is what's, I think, really interesting, because people like Blinken and Power really came of intellectual age after the Cold War, the era of the indispensable nation. So what you have, at least in my historical reading, is a Cold War logic existing in a non-Cold War world. So you have this idea that American military supremacy is the necessary font of peace and prosperity, and that you need a type of U.S. global dominance now that there's no existential ideological enemy to ensure peace and prosperity around the world. And this is what I really think people like Blinken, Sullivan, and Power, they genuinely believe that world peace and prosperity depends on American global leadership. And that sometimes means using military force to intervene to, you know, stop a massacre at Benghazi. That does eventually and very quickly turn into the deposition of Muammar Gaddafi. But, you know, you have to save the babies in Benghazi. And so I think this is what is really important to understand, is that you have people operating with a Cold War logic in a non-Cold War world. Now, maybe, you know, they've come to Jesus in the last 4 years, but that's not what I read, or that's not I understood when Trump, when they were criticizing Trump. It was all about sort of returning to the status quo ante. This is what people at the Council on Foreign Relations were saying, at the Brookings Institution were saying. And so the question is, how do they navigate that? And we'll see.
And what role does the Cold War with China have in that?
Right. So I think that it's really important to understand that there is a lot of interests that want the United States to remain militarily dominant. It's not just people like Samantha Power and Blinken who like don't really, I mean, they do make money off of it, Blinken especially, but you know, their main bag is policy. They want to make policy. They want to exercise power. But there's a bunch of interests from defense contractors like Raytheon and Boeing. But even, I think this is where it gets thorny, from congressional representatives and even from labor unions and people who work in munitions factories, and maybe not munitions factories, but weapons factories today, who want the maintenance of at least a structure that allows capital to be put towards building the weapons of the American empire. You also have people who are like in think tanks like RAND or Brookings, CFR, whomever, who also make their careers off of providing guideposts and a plan for this very American empire. And so you have this large coalition of forces that is organized around the maintenance of the status quo. So what does this have to do with the new Cold War with China? I mean, what's better than a new Cold War to provide essentially a justifying logic for the consistent maintenance of an American imperial system, both abroad with the famous 750 military bases, but also at home, where you know you get the building of the F-35, you get all of this pork going to underpopulated regions throughout the country, et cetera, et cetera. So what a new Cold War with China does is it provides a sort of logic to allow that to go. The difference is that, unlike the old Cold War, is that there's really an economic imbrication between the United States and China in a way that there wasn't between the United States and the Soviet Union. There's some trade, there's not like there's nothing, but the type of economic connections between the U.S. and China just dwarf what happened during the first Cold War. So the question is, how do policymakers sort of thread that needle with advocating this, war against this ideology, against this evil empire, when there's serious economic intertwinement that really neither country, as it currently stands, is able to walk away from without devastating consequences? China still wants to continue to develop. It still wants to continue to improve its middle class, especially because at this point, when there's no one who really believes in the CCP any longer, the Chinese, the party itself and Xi himself, their legitimacy rests on expanding the middle class. Mm-hmm. So they can't really just detach from the United States. And similarly, the United States for decades now, and we see this in sort of the emphasis on consumption, it's a consumer society. And the only way that we're able to consume as much as we do is because of countries like China and their ability to produce cheap goods because of their awful labor conditions, et cetera, et cetera. So they can't really separate. So then what does that mean for a new Cold War? And I think we're going to find out.
Well, I would just sort of, piggyback off of that and say, one thing that I think is unique about the moment that we're living in, comparing it to the old Cold War with the Soviet Union, is that you had an ideological battle, the Soviet Union battle, okay, we need to be on top or else they'll come and take over society, take away our freedoms. China is really interesting because there's a kind of pop understanding that the reason that we are in economic decline, the reason that the standard of living in the United States for working people has gone down is because China is taking all the jobs from us, right? And they're basically cheating, which does create an interesting intellectual development, politically at least, domestically in the United States, for people think that something has to be done about China. That is in a little bit of a different logic than just, saber rattling and saying, we need to defeat the upcoming empire.
Right, because there's a real constituency here that more or less believes that their own degraded economic position is directly linked to China.
Yes, it's China, it's not globalization, right? It's not like the United States' role in undermining these systems across the globe. It's actually just China.
Right, which is why the what Trump did do, he had, as you guys know, he had tariff policies in China, right? He didn't really try to arrest globalization. He tried to, prevent steel imports or whatever it may be. And so and this is something that Steve Bannon, himself has focused on for years, this whole China thing. Now, the question is, how does that sort of interact with the QAnon conspiracy, which is, seems to be ever more powerful, particularly during COVID, which isn't quite the same thing. I don't know. There's sort of a miasma of conspiracy theory on the contemporary right, and China's definitely there for the taking. And it'll be interesting to see what Joe Biden does or doesn't do with that.
I got this clip where Biden, this was from July 2019, Biden talking about forever wars. And I think we just play that and then talk about Afghanistan, maybe.
Long past time we end the forever wars, which have cost us untold blood and treasure. I have long argued that we should bring home the vast majority of our combat troops from the wars in Afghanistan and the Middle East and narrowly focus on our mission to deal with Al-Qaeda and ISIS in the region.
So, Daniel, you think there's how do you read that?
Right. So this is actually, Biden has been advocating something along these lines for a long time. What is referred to in sort of the literature as a counterterrorism policy, which is kind of different. It's not as intense as a nation building policy, but it's kind of approaching terrorism as a police issue. So what does that mean? It means less troops on the ground, and it means American money, American military advisors, and American developed tech basically spread throughout the world to prevent, supposed terrorism. And of course, unsurprisingly, a lot of countries around the world have recognized that if you say the word terrorism, then you're going to, the American pocketbook will open to you. So what that essentially means is it's actually kind of analogous to drones. So you get this sort of liberal move to clean war where you get proxies to undertake what you want to be done. Or you pay people to do what you want to do without putting American lives, putting American people on the ground. And, this could go very bad. And I just want to highlight The Intercept, their recent story about the CIA-trained Afghan death squads that have gone around, killed at least 51 billion people, including boys as young as 8, children, very, very young children. And that's the type of thing that, let fewer boots on the ground lead to in the absence of an actual anti-imperial structural policy. So I think we'll see something along those lines. And why I say it's analogous to drones is that it's these approaches and strategies that don't require masses amounts of people or masses amounts of money.
Interesting, yeah. And like Pompeo's recent sanctioning of Iran, you write, I think it was on the Foreign Exchanges, that the key is like whether Biden requires new conditions from Iran before going back in the deal. Is that right? Or how are you looking at the Iran deal under this administration?
Right. So the question, I mean, if I were Iran, I wouldn't necessarily be too eager to get into another deal with the United States. So the JCPOA, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, was, you know, Obama did force Iran to do that with heavy sanctions for years and years and years. And there are sanctions still on Iran now. But then the question the Iranian government has to ask itself is, I mean, related to a lot of its internal politics about its legitimacy and things along those lines. But at the, let's just take the strategic level, can they really trust the United States, right? I mean, what Trump genuinely did do was demonstrate that a new president, at the norm of presidents abiding by deals that were signed by earlier presidents are no longer holds in a real serious way. So if you're Iran, what does that mean? I think it's difficult to then for them to say that we shouldn't pursue a nuclear weapon. And then, you know, there's the whole old argument made by the famous IR theorist Kenneth Waltz, which is that, and you hear kind of echoes of it in realists today, like Steve Waltz. And Steve, if I'm misquoting you, I misunderstand. But Ken Waltz definitely made this argument, which was that nuclear proliferation was actually safer because it actually prevents the types of Iraq-type action, the Libya-type action, the Afghanistan-type action that the United States could just go around the world like a 600-pound gorilla. And I imagine that what North Korea was able to successfully do, which is to get a nuclear capability, and now the United States is not nearly as safe or rattling with North Korea as it was in the early 2000s. Imagine a lot of world leaders are looking at that, and they're going to, you know, and Iran being one of them, going to more forcefully try to get that weapon. And this is also, of course, related to what the United States does. It's interesting because I think you are beginning to see among sort of the cognoscente of the American foreign policy establishment, this sort of like assumption that the United States is not going to be in the Middle East forever, that American interests just aren't strong enough there. You know, famously, a lot of the oil mostly goes to Europe, et cetera, et cetera. So I think if the United States does say we don't really have a dog in the Saudi-Iranian fight in a serious way, and that, you know, Israel's strong enough, you know, as the 51st state to you know, rely on U.S. protection, you could also see a ratcheting up of Iranian attempts to get a nuclear weapon. I mean, that's what I would guess. Iran gets a breakout capability in the next 10, 15 years, maybe even sooner. But we'll see.
Yeah, I mean, that lesson, the North Korean lesson, really kind of rings in people's ears, I think, at this point. So,
of course, Saddam was overthrown. You know, Gaddafi was overthrown, and Gaddafi was welcomed back into the international community because he gave up his nuclear program. I mean, that was really, I mean, to what degree does that really matter? I don't know. But if you're a third, I'm using the Cold War term, if you're a leader in the global south and you're looking at the world and you're seeing who gets deposed and who doesn't, it's pretty obvious.
Yeah. So we do want to get to the domestic war on division at some point, but there was, you had this article in the Foreign Exchanges, Building Back Better, where it had a good list of 20 action items, including a sort of defensive task forces, which I enjoyed. But I also want kind of you make two cases that you made in there quickly that I found interesting. So first, the case for leaving NATO. What's the case for the left supporting leaving NATO?
Oh, I think it's actually pretty simple. The Europeans are rich. There's no reason for the United States to be responsible for their defense. There's not going to be a World War III in Europe. They also know what's going on in their region better. And I just think that, I mean, as a philosophical, this is my philosophical issue. People in their homes and their regions know better than the United States what should happen in those regions. And so I think that's number one. And again, you know, the United States isn't, it's not 1945. The United States does not have to pay for Germany, France's Germany and France's defense.
Right. And then
they were also very mean to our boy, Donnie. Very, very cruel to him.
Very mean to our poor Donnie.
And then the other one, the case for boosting migrants, resettlement for migrants and refugees.
Right. So this is the question the left always gets, right? This is what Samantha Power will ask you. How dare you not you know, defend democracy when it's under threat in Hong Kong, or, you know, or the Uyghurs, a general horrible human rights abuse is happening in Xinjiang, right? That's a legitimate thing. The left should not just wave, in my opinion, the left should not just be like, we can't do anything, so forget about it. You know, there's a moral case to be made that we should be against concentration camps, regardless of where they are. So then the question is, what do you do, right? If that's a genuine moral problem, what do you do? And my answer is that the only thing that you could morally do as an ethical leftist is basically welcome in as many refugees as humanly possible, give them capital in order to resettle in this country. It's a gigantic country with a lot of space. And if you wanted to be really, you know, clever about it, why not link that resettlement to a jobs programs for American citizens and help, you know, pay them to help these people resettle so they don't view them as people who are going to take their jobs. And I just want to emphasize, you know, a little bit behind the curtain, this was actually something that I had sent to the Bernie Sanders campaign. And so, you know, it was like, what are your, you know, big pie in the sky ideas? And so this was a curated list of that with a little more explanation here. So that's what I was, you know, thinking.
Yeah, I'd recommend people check out that full list.
Do you mind if I ask you a question off the cuff, Daniel?
Of course.
When it comes to something like, you know, the question of like the Uyghurs, I think a lot of people on the left who consider themselves to be like anti-imperialists or anti-interventionists have a really difficult time with being able to hold those two ideas in their head at once. It's like one that, you know, there are actual human rights abuses that are going on the world over, but also the United States shouldn't invade them. And I think particularly what a lot of people who like are deniers, because that's a really – that is something that I think is significant, at least on the online left. It's like there's just a reaction. If you hear about something bad that happens in another country, you just say it's a psyop. And I think it comes out of a genuine fear that if people on the left acknowledge any of these things, then it gives ammunition to the right or to like the hawks. Is there any good pushback that you can have other than just like the moral case? It's like, hey, let's not deny basic human rights abuses by using political calculations to which ones we're going to accept and which ones we're going to deny.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's true. Like, no one wants to be a dupe, right? And the American government has in the past exaggerated these things in order to gin up support for whatever political program. But I think one also has to do – I mean, just the truth of the matter is one has to do the research. It's not – in my mind, it's not controversial to say that what's happening in Xinjiang with the Uyghurs is an abuse of human rights, right? I just don't think there's any real evidence for that. But then I think that then the question is – the question people have is always, what do you do? And so why I say we don't intervene is because obviously so many things should go wrong. The United States doesn't know what's going on the ground. We shouldn't have World War III with China. But also that's just the very fact that if the United States maintains the military capabilities to do that type of intervention, that means we haven't done our job, because that means the American military empire is still existing. Right. So the problem is, if you are genuinely anti-imperialist and you genuinely want to get rid of this global basing structure, you can't simultaneously also have this sort of pro intervention policy, regardless of what it may be. And the thing about people who get conspiratorial, I mean, the truth of the matter is you do want to, you know, be aware that you don't want to be tricked by the American government, but you also don't want to go to the other side, which is to deny, you know, things that are plainly happening in on the earth. One, because that's intellectually dishonest. And two, that's not going to win over many adherents to the left wing position.
All right, so let's move on to the domestic war on division. I'll let you talk about your run-in with some prominent liberals on Twitter if you want a little bit later. You can give your side of the story, because Isaac Schottner and Matt Iglesias didn't let you. I first want to play this clip of Alyssa Slotkin, former CIA analyst and now a representative, saying a lot of things I don't agree with, but I'm interested by the idea that now the post 9/11 era is over, and I'm just curious what you think about, as we enter the new era, what you think that we need to be on guard for in the post 9/11 era.
You know, can we just accept that the post 9/11 era is over? We are in a new era, right? We had a generational event with the you know, infiltration of the Capitol, and the era of the primary threats to the United States being external. Right? Threats coming from abroad, from foreign terrorist organizations, from China, from Russia. They're still serious. But the single greatest national security threat right now is our internal division. It's the threat of domestic terrorism. It's that polarization that threatens our democracy. And we've had a visual representation of that 2 days ago.
Yeah. So, Daniel, what do you think about this?
Oh, it's brilliant. So, the security state and people like Alyssa Slotkin, who've made their careers within the security state and have so imbibed its logic, has been very successful in sort of rebranding itself over the last 70 years. I know you guys know this, but perhaps people don't. It starts with a genuine anti-fascism, but that quickly morphs into what I think is a less genuine anti-communism. And when the Cold War ends, that morphs into something else. This is the era of Samantha Power and people like Tony Blinken, where the United States is going to stop genocide around the world and ensure the Holocaust doesn't happen again. And it's actually pretty interesting. Just look at it. I know you guys are into culture stuff too. Like, why has it happened that Schindler's List is made in 1993? Why is the U.S. Holocaust Museum opened in 1993 or get started planning in the mid 1980s? Why is Saving Private Ryan made in 1998? Because I think you see an effort in the 1990s to justify the existence of the American Empire in the absence of an existential enemy. I'm not sure that would have succeeded, but luckily for the security state, 9/11 happens. And so you have another existential enemy, this time jihadist Islam. And then you very quickly get the morphing of Islam and fascism, right? With Jonah Goldberg's famous book, Islamofascism, and things along those lines. And of course, Saddam Hussein was famously referred to as another Hitler. So you get sort of these old tropes being used to justify the continuation of the security state. And now you're getting that a little bit with China. And what you see, what Slotkin is doing, is basically trying to provide another articulation of a security logic that would justify the continued existence of all of these structures by pointing to domestic terrorists, right? She's saying now this is the epochal struggle with QAnon, I guess, and that you have to, you know, devote all of these security resources to guaranteeing that these elements of society aren't allowed to flourish. And while I would admit that the far right is absolutely a problem, and we can get into this a bit more, I think it's a real concern about leftists should have a real concern about inflating threats to the degree where they serve as functionally, and I don't mean this in the literal sense, but, you know, what people used to term fellow travelers function as essentially useful idiots for their security state. I think we have to be on guard about that, especially given the power that the state has accrued in the last two decades. It's really incredible, again, especially given the technological capabilities that the U.S. government has access to.
And it was just like, it was really frustrating to see over this past week, just like the giddiness that a lot of people were having watching the security state, particularly people snitching to the FBI, adding the FBI, which one is hilarious to think that like the FBI is gonna be like, oh, I wasn't gonna arrest this guy, but I got a tweet from, you know, at, you know,
whatever. 10,000 likes on that one. We better 10,000
likes. Oh, well, I'm gonna go arrest this guy. But just like the idea that that'd be something that you would want to do would be to participate in anyway, even as a joke, with this horrendous organization is something that I do think is particularly worrying. And this whole idea that like the problem with the United States and the problem with the far right, I would have to argue, is not a lack of laws when it comes to the activities that the far right, you know, gets into.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's absolutely right. And I don't think any new laws or any expansion of the security state will effectively attack the cause of whatever the events of January 6th were.
Yeah, I mean, just to simplify, we don't need to get into really like the QAnon from the fascists. Like, a stolen election requires a nonviolent response. Like, just by that logic, I think we don't have – Biden didn't steal the election, though. The problem is the lies about the stolen election. So I think the over-focus on, like, the people – like, look, they suck. I hate like, the people that brought guns, like, I think they're, like, you know, they do whatever at any point in history, the worst thing, right? Whatever you want to call it. But, like, fundamentally, if you have a Republican Party that's saying this election is not legitimate – like, you can't counterterrorism your way out of that problem.
Mm-hmm.
No, and also, like, I think it's important to actually – it's fun. Whenever I talk with people who disagree with me with that, I'm like, all right, take me through the five-step program of the far right taking over the republic. You know, it's ridiculous. It is just – it is a scary group that is no doubt capable of spectacular acts of individualistic violence. That is absolutely something that is real, and that is something with which the left should not stick its head in the sand and should be concerned. However, they are not a structural threat to the presently existing liberal capitalist order in the way the Nazis were, or in the way Mussolini was, you know, or the way in Pinochet's Chile. You know, these are different things, and we shouldn't. And if the last 2 decades have taught us anything, it's to deflate rather than inflate threats.
And I just want to add, because we covered this last week, obviously, but I think it's important. One, like, yes, you know, what happened there was, you know, we all know what we have all seen enough images to come up with our own opinions of it. But I think it should be understood by most people that this is an act of desperation. It was also an act of spectacle. That's why you have all these people dressing up in costumes and taking selfies and having a party. Right. This was not a movement that was, you know, flexing its muscle in the sense like, okay, we're going to take over the government right now. This was an act of desperation to just like express an anger that was felt by, you know, a group of, you know, petty bourgeois to, you know, some members of the working class, right? I think you're 100%, Danny, when you say that, like, it's really important not to overinflate these threats, because that gives them a huge advantage, actually. If it makes it seem like, okay, this is the popular movement of history, this is the way that things are going in this country, that makes them seem a lot stronger than, you know, a significant group, but a fringe group nonetheless, that basically, you know, threw a tantrum on Wednesday and had a little bit of a festival.
And this is why people got really mad at me, because what I think I had a tweet where I said, like, liberal technocratic, what was it? Technocratic imperialist liberalism is still the most dangerous threat. And what I mean by that is that the current constellation of forces in this country that actually hold power are the presidential administration that is mm-hmm. about to take power in a week, but also the sort of bureaucratic security state, you know, these unelected bureaucrats, these unelected officials who genuinely believe in American world leadership and, you know, American domestic surveillance as crucial to ensuring that the safety of the republic. And this is just going to embolden them, allow policymakers to just let them do what they do and basically have the liberal elite, as it has done since 9/11, just sort of roll over and say, in the battle between civil liberties and security wins no matter what. And I think this is what that discussion essentially does. And people got really mad at that. And I imagine because they saw themselves in that criticism. I could only imagine. But I just have to say, I did offer Matt Iglesias and Isaac Chotiner the privilege of being interviewed by me. They both declined. They don't want to get pushed on these issues in any stretch of the imagination. I feel like such a Ben Shapiro tool doing it. But, you know, you gotta play on the playing field of your enemies.
I think the picture tweet is cowards. Like, oh, yeah. I got into it with a guy with 10 times my following tonight. And you know what I did? I actually quoted a tweet of his and I engaged with him, because that's what men do, Isaac Chotiner. and you can almost hear like the cash register sounds from suburban Virginia when you, like, the phrase like woke counterterrorism comes in. Yeah. Well, Daniel, anything else you want to inform us about tonight?
No. Just I wish you guys best of luck in what will no doubt be a successful endeavor. And thanks so much for having me on.
All right. And you'll be back soon. Thank you so much.
Bye.
Take care. Man, that was good.
So good.
You know, do you mind, just while we're on this subject, I just want to tease a little bit from our theory reading group that we do for patrons, but I took an excerpt from an essay by Jean-Paul Sartre on anti-Semitism, kind of psychological study of it. And I just wanted to hit on it because last week we were sort of dancing around it, and I was just mentioning it again, how important it is to note the kind of like cartoonish or clownish, the jokingness of like this alt-right movement and, you know, this kind of ideology in particular. And it was just interesting because we were curious last week, we were wondering if like Nazism had the same kind of tendency. You know, we're finding out that no doubt that it did. So let me get this real quick. So this is Sartre's essay from this is from Sartre's essay, Anti-Semite and Jew, where he sort of does a psychological study, a desire study of the anti-Semite. And I think this is really interesting here.
This is also the one where he, I think it's where he like says like, anti-Semites think more about Judaism than Jews themselves.
Life
is more consumed by it.
But here, it's a little bit of a long run, but it's good. The anti-Semite has chosen hate because hate is a faith. At the outset, he has chosen to devaluate words and reasons. How entirely at ease he feels as a result. How futile and frivolous discussions about the rights of the Jew appear to him. He has placed himself on other ground from the beginning. If out of courtesy, he consents for a moment to defend his point of view, he lends himself but does not give himself. He tries simply to project his intuitive certainty onto the plane of discourse. I mentioned a while back some remarks by anti-Semites, all of them absurd. I hate Jews because they make servants insubordinate because a Jewish fur robbed me, whatever. Never believe that the anti-Semites are completely unaware of the absurdity of their replies. They know that their remarks are frivolous, open to challenge, but they are musing themselves, for it is their adversary who is obliged to use words responsibly, since he believes in words. The anti-Semites have the right to play. They even like to play with discourse, for by giving ridiculous reasons, they discredit the seriousness of their interlocutors. They delight in acting in bad faith, since they seek not to persuade by sound argument, but to intimidate and disconcert. If you press them too closely, they will abruptly fall silent, loftily indicating by some phrase that the time for argument is past. It is not that they are afraid of being convinced. They fear only to appear ridiculous or to prejudice by their embarrassment, their hope of winning over some third person to their side. And it was just sort of an interesting.
He predicted Twitter.
He predicted Twitter. And it's like, as the essay goes on, and I mentioned this in the, when I posted this on Patreon, is that for a lot of these folks, it's like, they need you to reflect themselves. Right. Like they need to be the thing that is like triggering the libs. It's very much a part of them. And that's why this kind of alt-right movement in this country in this moment in time is so fixated on the spectacle of having people react to them, because they need the image of you to like to imbue them with a sense of strength. Like that's fundamentally what it is. And I know that's like school kid reasoning is like the bullies, you know, just want to get a rise out of you, but it's 100% that ideology. And it's just interesting to see the similarities between, you know, meme culture today, and, you know, from the alt-right folks and what was happening in Europe in the 20th century.
It's amazing. Before I share this, I want to say, like, I do not think people should be prosecuted for jokes. And I think we should be 100% behind anybody who is prosecuted for jokes. That said, I want to share this thread from YouGarls on Twitter, which is about some of the guys in that stormed the Capitol, and they're trying to use a joke defense. And it's pretty remarkable. So Meredith's lawyer is saying his texts were meant as a joke. Meredith wrote that he wanted to put a bullet in Nancy Pelosi's noggin on live TV. He also wrote of Mayor Bowser, "I may wander over to the mayor's office and put a 456 in her skull." He says, "Haha, good one." Another guy says, this is all about Bassett still. So yeah, I mean, the joke defense, when you're storming a parliamentary building with firearms, is a bit difficult for right wingers, but I mean your point regarding online discourse. I mean, what I'm curious about is, where was he encountering so many anti-Semites in discourse?
In France?
Yeah, in France. Like, what was that? Was it pamphlets or what?
I mean, anti-Semitism was huge in France at that period. But when of time.
I guess, is he just arguing with them?
I guess in argument, and also, you know, Sartre is a good philosopher in the continental tradition, where he is able to create his opponent and analyze them. But it was very much like what I'm saying is, like, this wasn't a sociological study where he's like, I've gone through all the texts and like went undercover to a meeting. He couldn't have done that.
But that's it's very perceptive. And I'm just thinking, like, I mean, I know how I came to that realization, but like prior to an environment where I'm constantly arguing, like on Twitter, I guess it maybe if you're like the Sorbonne or whatever, wherever he was, and you're arguing with students, maybe that makes a lot more sense actually. But I mean, those patterns, I run into that all the time. It's pretty horrifying.
No, it's just definitely interesting. And, you know, again, I agree with you, Matt. And I think everything we were saying earlier, like, I didn't bring this up, by the way, to make a Nazi analogy. I just meant, brought it up to sort of look how interesting these kind of, you know, racist movements, do mirror each other in their, you know, absurdity and their just attachment to the joke. I mean, it's like, it's just a real deep attachment, to the meme. I actually don't think that those people making those arguments, they were actually being cynical. I think they were actually being more honest than they've been in a long time by saying, like, I was just joking around, which, like, half of this movement really is just like, you know, it's hateful. And you have to convince yourself, you have to poison yourself with such a layer of irony that you cannot see other people as full human beings. I mean, that is like the racist perspective, is to just deny other people's their humanity. And it's cruel, but it's a reality of it. It's like the absurdity and the humor is a huge part of that as well.
Right. Yeah. Damn.
Anyways, just some interesting things over that we're getting over to on the Patreon. But there's a couple of stories I think we should get to before we jump over to the post game, if you're good for that.
Down for that.
Particularly, I wanted to reset here for a second and talk about what's going on in Indian country. In particular, what has just happened, and this is, as we were talking about at the beginning of the show, this is not unique to this one story. This is something that is going on across the country, which is just the complete and utter failure of the United States government to provide for its citizens in this coronavirus crisis. But also really devastating how much the United States government has failed Native peoples during this crisis. So in New Mexico, a hospital that was run by the federal government, run by the Indian Health Service, has cut back services drastically, meaning for many Pueblo Indians, they have to drive hours on hours to get just basic care, let alone the kind of care that they need to deal with COVID. And that's at a time when positive rates for COVID are almost double in Indian country what they are in the rest of the United States. And look, this is 100% a result of the Trump administration and what it has done, you know, and its failures and, you know, looking out for people as human beings. But these are structural crises that have been developing for a really long time. And what Matt's putting up right now is something that is incredibly devastating about this story, which is, not only are we facing this loss of just life in general, which is devastating, but there has been a severing of connection between, you know, younger people and the elderly. And in the Native community, that is quite devastating when you realize that so many of members of the elder community are some of the few fluent speakers of their languages, some of the few people who are able to maintain, you know, traditions and also
historical record,
and people who have just the basic kind of human knowledge, you know, let alone the actual just human connection of people in your family and your community and not wanting them to die. This has become a serious, you know, this is a medical crisis and economic crisis that is also now becoming a cultural crisis. And, you know, just to mention really quick about what's happening in New Mexico, this is the result of underfunding and bad management for years upon years, long before the coronavirus hit. Because what's happened is that the Laguna Pueblo, and this hospital serves, I think, three different, tribes in the area. But they have now said that they're going to, they had long time, a couple months ago, I would think at the beginning of 2020, have said that they want to take their share of federal funding that goes into that hospital to run a health clinic on their own lands, because the United States run health service was so damn, it was so, you know, inadequate before even the COVID crisis. And it's only gotten worse. So look, these people were basically saying that we want to be able to manage our own care and make sure that we're getting the best quality care, because we know sure as hell we're not getting it from the United States government. And now what we're getting, and it's reported in places like the New York Times, is this smear campaign. Oh, these people are being selfish and they're putting all these people in the region at risk. It's like, no, the United States government put those people at risk when they continually underfunded these communities. You know, and yeah, as I was saying earlier, it's like, it's devastating to see the severing in communities. And this is not just happening in New Mexico. It's happening in the Dakotas. It's happening all across Indian country. You know, and, you know, there's no doubt that this is caused by the subpar healthcare system in this country, but also years of poverty that were caused by broken treaties and forced economic neglect. I mean, people are forced out into parts of the country. A lot of these reservations are constantly under challenge from the United States government whenever it's discovered, oh, there's some, there's something worthwhile here. Oh, look, is there some mineral resources? Oh, actually, now that we're looking at your map, it doesn't seem like, your reservation covers this silver mine or this uranium mine, and we're actually going to come in and force you out. I mean, it's just devastating to see the small slivers that people have been forced into. And whenever there's an economic opportunity, there's always, a move back from the U.S. government. Like, so these are long-time crises that are culminating in just this horrific moment where people are losing, their elders. And
like those elders saw, like, it's not just like the Black Hills 120 years ago. A lot of those elders, like of the Lakota, for instance, would have been there when, like, say, Kennedy came in his one visit to the Dakotas in the 60s to announce, we're going to, flood a lot of your lands. I mean, he wasn't talking to the Native Americans. We're going to flood, we're going to install hydro projects that are going to flood native lands in basically every place we put up a dam on the Missouri River. That political information is interesting for us from a selfish reason. And, I don't want to stress that all of the knowledge that is being lost is like this horrible, there's a lot of culture that's being lost too. But related to this Indian Health Service stuff is the story that also came out yesterday. Frontline, I think, did a documentary. Judge rules U.S. Indian Health Service must disclose sex abuse report. And there's this guy who, Dr. Stanley Weber, and the Indian Health Service, which provides health services to 2.6 million Native Americans, claimed that the report was basically medical privacy, the report. This is a quality assurance thing. We can't give it to you. But of course, it's not that. It's one of the lawyers says, it's basically entirely exclusively an assessment of Weber and other sex crimes and the bureaucratic failures that let their conduct go unpunished. Now, sex crimes against Native Americans particularly is just, I mean, that's something the U.S. government does. Mm-hmm. Like, you look at like the way missionary schools, the dark history of those, wherever they've been, like wherever they were, comes with this kind of abuse. And that still in 2021, we have a guy who's being protected by a government agency that's supposed to administer their health. And he's everyone knows Jim Jordan, asshole, right? But what the fuck's going on at the Indian Health Services?
No doubt.
Disgusting.
And I just wanted to piggyback off of that too and mention that this is from that New York Times piece that we put up a second ago, just like the real humanity of people in the tribal nations. And what they've been doing, Navajo women started a campaign to deliver meals and sanitizer to high desert trailers, remote homes without running water where elders have been left stranded. They post cardboard signs in their windows, green for okay, red for help. In Montana, volunteers led a grocery store, led by grocery store workers, put together turkey dinners and hygiene packets to deliver to Blackfeet elders. And also, in Standing Rock, the Standing Rock Sioux, because of the failures of this government, had to create their own contact tracing teams after the North Dakota and South Dakota governments failed to track the virus. It's just a constant fight, again, to get this kind of basic health care. We want to continue to highlight these struggles to, one, hope that there can be some kind of a political change. I know there's already, the Biden administration has already said that they are going to investigate the closing of the hospital in New Mexico. And we just need to continue shining light on these issues because they're happening all across the country. They're not limited to health. But the United States has a deep moral obligation to make sure that they are at least fulfilling their treaty obligations. And I would argue to exceed those for the historical wrongs that have been done there.
Absolutely. So before we get to the post game, I just want to update people on at least what I'm seeing. We're going to suss this out more in the break before the post game, but Jeff Stein reporting some good, I mean, Bernie Sanders' statement, President-elect Biden has put forth a very strong first installment of an emergency relief plan, a first installment. So Bernie there saying we're going to get two stabs. I think that's, we'll see. AOC is also saying we need the full 2000, not, the $1,600 or $1,400 top up. We're going to look into more what Biden's relief package is. It's hard to kind of, glean this up as we're doing a show, but, we'll see.
No, exactly. We'll definitely get to that in the post game. And before we jump over, I just want to get this in the main show real quick. Just an update real briefly on Prop 22, because it's an interesting story here. Obviously, Prop 22 is one of the most, I think, is going to be one of the most long lasting events of 2020, just what that has done for labor law and just the huge victory that these corporations, Uber and Lyft, along among the other gig corporations, got. But I want to start with some, you know, with some good news here, because you know we all are looking for places to fight, and this is a huge opportunity to continue the fight against Prop 22. A group of, actually, let me put this out for everybody, but basically there is going to be a significant legal challenge against Prop 22. This is in The Verge. Uber and Lyft drivers in California sue to overturn Prop 22 ballot measure. A group of Uber and Lyft drivers in California filed a lawsuit Tuesday in state Supreme Court to overturn a ballot measure that allows the companies to continue treating its workers like independent contractors. The drivers claim that Prop 22, which was approved, blah, blah, blah. Everyday rideshare drivers like me struggle to make ends meet because companies like Uber and Lyft prioritize corporate profits over our well-being. With Prop 22, they're not just ignoring our health and safety, they're discarding our state's constitution. So the drivers are challenging the constitutionality of Prop 22. They're being supported by the SEIU, the California Labor Federation. So that's an exciting development, and hopefully we'll be able to see, you know, some kind of pushback, because everyone knows who listens to this show, one Prop 22 is an absolute disaster, and it was a bill that was essentially bought by Uber and Lyft, among other corporations, who pumped in, over $200 million into it, which is just an unheard of sum for a ballot initiative.
Yeah, I saw this great reply to a tweet here on this topic from a driver, or someone identifying as a driver. Jathan Sadowski, so not shocking that Uber and Lyft lied. Oh, sorry, they strongly implied about not raising prices if Prop 22 passed. They planned on activating the next phase in the monopoly playbook this whole time. Dirty Hippie writes, I'll go one further. As a driver, I saw better pay in the months leading up to the vote, and riders were being charged more. The fear of more expensive rides was leveraged, and recency bias affected vote for sure. Drivers thought less pay, riders thought more money. Which is like, I mean, I would love to see more reporting on that, because that seems like exactly the type of thing you would do if you had this amount of data to, like, basically game your worker.
And this amount of data to basically, you know, set the table to give people kind of perspective as to what their future is. And yeah, as y'all saw in the tweet, despite the fact that Uber and Lyft ran on this idea that if they don't pass Prop 22, they're going to have to increase prices. Well, they get what they wanted. They spent $200 million to get that. And guess what? They continue with their plans to raise prices. It's going to be higher prices for rides, and also higher prices for things like Uber Eats, which I think they're increasing by like $2. So again, like, these companies make so much money off of the backs of all of these workers, and they profit immensely from this kind of shift that they're doing to try to change the way that we categorize workers. And it's all BS what we're getting from them about, like, the actual cost of that, because they make an incredible amount of money in the first place. They're just trying to make sure that they can squeeze as much as possible. And not only does this environment affect the people, the workers who work directly for those companies, we're also starting to get reports that now that Prop 22 is in effect, that people in other industries who aren't gig workers are losing their jobs. Because let me tell you one quick thing about capitalism. All workers, because this, the way that the system works, it makes working people compete against each other for jobs and resources. And you have to compete for those jobs and resources from the people who own everything, right? And the people who own everything in the system are always going to go for the cheapest labor that they can get. And when you create a two-tiered system like they have been able to create in California now, any capitalist worth their salt, and I'm sorry, they're all going to do this. There is no person who's going to be like, you know what, I'm just going to morally, you know, just lose money, right? That's not how the system
works. The only ones that will do that will be ones who make a media career out of, like, talking about how they did it.
Well, it's also like, if they do that, then they're not playing by the rules of the system. They're being bad at their what their job is in this system, which is to make as much money as possible. And hey, I think it's great for people to make individual choices not to abuse people, right? I think that's a great moral thing. But we have to talk about the large numbers of this system, the way that it's going to work functionally. And you end up, even if you do these kind of things at the beginning, right? You'd say, look, I'm not going to take advantage of this now cheaper labor market that's available to me. You put yourself at such a competitive disadvantage that eventually you get forced to do it. But let's get to the story real quick. In San Diego, delivery drivers laid off as Prop 22 takes effect. So this tells a story of a 27-year-old worker, Matthew, who works at a San Diego Vons, which I believe is a supermarket there. And basically, they thought that they were going to, I mean, this is so cruel. This is Matthew, what he told the news source KPBS. I thought they were so everyone got pulled into a all staff meeting, and he says, I thought they were going to give us a bonus or a raise or something like that. You know, after these people have been risking their lives to deliver groceries to people, but in fact, he found out that instead of a raise, Matthew and the other drivers were told their jobs were being eliminated, and they were going to be replaced by third party gig workers at the end of February.
It's they just told them that?
They just told them that. And, it's a disgusting story. And, Matthew, all solidarity to you and all of the workers there. He was mentioning in that story that he's, the breadwinner for his family. But it's exactly how these corporations are going to operate. Now that they have access to cheap labor, and now that you've created a gig economy, right, that can cover so many different kinds of workers. Of course, these corporations are going to move away from treating people like employees, right? Which was already precarious enough, right? People who aren't unionized. It was already precarious enough. It's going to get worse. So we need to, support this fight to overturn Prop 22 and be really vigilant across the country, because this is the move. I talked about in a Jackman video that went up earlier this week about, and I talked about this on the show too, the new rules from the Department of Labor, what they're doing to basically, kneecap front of the house workers in restaurants. The new way that capitalists are trying to squeeze from workers is to reclassify work, who is a worker and to try to reclassify them as independent contractors, because that means that they can just negate 150 years of labor organizing. And we have to be really vigilant about that.
Yeah. It's very disgusting. Well, folks, I think we're going to reconvene in another 40 minutes for the postgame viewers. Patreon.com/LeftReckoning if you want access to that. And until then, we will see you next week. And check out David's stream theory. That's stream tomorrow on YouTube, right?
Yeah, stream at 5 Eastern.
And actually, we should just talk about this real quick. We're going to be shifting the show back, I think, to 8 p.m. Eastern time, because that's a little bit – that's 7 p.m. Eastern time is a little bit East Coast prime time, and people are still working on the Pacific time and just getting off work in Mountain time and, finally getting home in Central time. So we're going to bump it back to 8 p.m. Starting next week, and so look to see you then.